From NPR News, you're listening to the best of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturday and Sunday. This episode, challenging the healthcare law with the help of the Constitution, plus the story of why Congress passed mandatory health insurance back in 1798, and later, the smartest man who ever lived. Also, turning Justin Bieber into Brian Eno, Ron Reagan on his iconic father, and indie rock darling Sam Beam explains the name behind his band Iron and Wine. Oh, man, he plays a few songs, too. That's on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. From NPR News, this is Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz. Behind all the rhetoric over the healthcare law is a constitutional debate over authority, the power to compel. Now, one of the key objections for most Republican lawmakers is what's called the individual mandate. That's the law that will require almost every American to become insured by 2014. Now, the idea is that as the marketplace for insurance grows, so will competition, and the price for getting coverage will go down. And it'll save taxpayers money, money that goes to pay for health care costs for the uninsured who get treatment but can't pay for it. Now, many Republicans say they don't have a problem with that idea. It's just that they believe Congress doesn't have the constitutional authority to make people buy insurance. We'll explore that question from both sides. That's our cover story today. But first, to the case of Camden, New Jersey. It's where physician and writer Atul Gawande recently went to find out how the city's medical system started to tackle skyrocketing medical costs.
One of the people I met was a man who was in his 50s with a liver cancer, didn't have insurance, was trying to use an emergency room to get treatment, and it just wasn't going to happen.
He would show up and what would happen?
They would treat the immediate problem and tell him he needed to go find a doctor who would help get him treatment for his cancer.
But every few weeks, even days, the man would show up at the emergency room complaining of pain.
They would give him pain medication. They would give him CT scans to see what was going on with the source of the pain. Maybe it was an appendicitis this time, make sure it's not that. What he didn't have was a consistent person who knew him, could work with him through the series of things that happen to a patient with what turns out to be a cancer of the liver.
In most cities, including Camden, 5% of patients account for 60% of healthcare costs, and many of them are uninsured. And in the case of the liver cancer patient,
his costs had risen so high that he turned up as a hotspot in the Camden cost data.
Treatment that often costs up to $50,000 a year per patient. And Atul Gawande says what often happens in these cases is that emergency rooms themselves end up paying the costs.
The hospital at that point chalks it up as uncompensated care. They set collection agencies on people who haven't paid their emergency room bill, but eventually they write it off. The state then will often pay for it. There are uncompensated care pools in most states where they help try to offset the losses that hospitals have from the patients coming in. The costs mount and mount, but no one actually looks at solving the problems.
There's a lot more to this story. You can read it in the latest issue of The New Yorker. Atul Gawande also practices at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and he teaches at the Harvard School of Public Health. Now, many conservative lawmakers would agree that the story we just heard is a problem, and some might even agree with the idea that if everyone were insured, health insurance costs would fall for everyone. But what those same conservatives object to is the idea that everyone must have insurance. They say that the Commerce Clause in the Constitution and even Congress's tax authority doesn't cover this question. Here's California Congressman Dan Lundgren, a Republican.
What Congress has attempted to do, and the president by signing the bill, is to say to the individual citizen, you are required to enter into a contract, that is, you are required to buy a product, in this case, something called health care insurance or health care coverage. And if you do not, you will suffer a penalty. So if you accept the fact that one's participation in one's own health care is somehow a matter of interstate commerce, in this case, it goes even beyond that. It says that if you refuse to enter into interstate commerce, that is, if you consciously decide to be inactive, that in and of itself is a type of interstate commerce. I mean, it's a question that if you answer it in the way that those who support this bill answer it, it leaves you no room to Well, for any concept of freedom, if you really think about
it. So you would argue, just to clarify, that health insurance is not a form of commerce.
In this particular case, it goes beyond that. It goes to the question of whether you can be mandated to enter into it. I mean, the famous case decades ago goes to the question of whether someone who is a farmer and is growing wheat, I think it was, or corn or whatever the commodity was, could produce it in their own backyard or basically in a small part of their farm for their own personal use, and whether that would violate the laws that then existed with respect to the limits on production. And the Supreme Court said in that case that, in fact, you were entering into interstate commerce by producing it even in that situation for your own consumption. Here, you're not doing anything. Here you're being told by the government, you must enter into this. And your failure to enter into it is evidence of the fact that you're involved in interstate commerce.
I mean, your argument is that, of course, that Americans should have the right to decide whether or not they want to have health care, right?
Oh, absolutely. Look, if the federal government can tell you to do this now, why can they not say that we have an epidemic of obesity in this country and therefore, as a condition of remaining a citizen or being in this country legally, you must join an approved health center program that is identified specifically by the federal government as being acceptable? What's the difference, essentially, if they can require you to purchase this particular product in these certain circumstances? I don't know another circumstance in wherein the federal government has obligated you to go out and purchase something that you otherwise may not want to purchase.
But the question I have for you is the argument made by supporters of the bill, which they would argue that, look, if you don't have some kind of mandate, those people end up in emergency rooms. Oftentimes they don't pay, and those costs are then passed on to people like you and me who do have health insurance and do pay premiums. So we end up footing a large part of that bill.
Well, that's a different question. That's the question of how you provide health care to people. That's not a question of whether the Constitution allows you to answer that specific inquiry in this particular way. You know, when you really get down to it, I've never seen something as clear-cut as this instance of requiring under penalty of a fine that you purchase a product produced by a non-governmental entity. It's an extraordinary reach once you start to analyze what it is you are actually talking about.
That's Dan Lundgren. He's a Republican congressman from California and the former attorney general in that state. He argues that the individual mandate in the health care law is unconstitutional. Congressman Lundgren, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
So is it as clear-cut as Dan Lundgren argues? Well, no. According to many constitutional law experts, including Andrew Koppelman, who teaches law at Northwestern University.
One of the remarkable things about this whole argument is that constitutional theories that a couple of years ago everyone would have agreed were wrong have gotten resuscitated. And so you have a large group of people stating things that's been settled for decades aren't the case. And folks in unison are saying them. That doesn't make them true. I noticed that Representative Lundgren was very careful not to mention the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution. After the Constitution enumerates the powers of Congress, it says that it can regulate commerce among the several states. It has the power to collect taxes to provide for the general welfare. And then the list of congressional powers ends with an authorization to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry out its responsibilities. The necessary and proper provision means that in order to carry out its responsibilities, Congress can do things that are not among the enumerated powers. So when somebody goes without health insurance, you know, we could argue about whether they are or are not part of interstate commerce, but it doesn't matter. It's necessary to carry out what Congress does have the power to do. The basic idea of the mandate was that unless you require people to buy health insurance, then since people with pre-existing conditions are protected and allowed to buy insurance, healthy people can wait until they get sick to buy insurance, and that would bankrupt the whole health insurance system because nobody would be paying into the pools. So the only way to protect people with pre-existing conditions is to force healthy people into the system.
But if the federal government can require all of us to have insurance, and for those who don't have insurance, to buy it, why wouldn't it be able to then pass a whole series of other requirements that would force Americans to engage in other commercial activity?
Well, Congress has authority, and authority can be abused. Congress has the taxing authority, and that means that Congress could, if it wanted to, impose a 100% tax on all incomes, which would destroy the American economy. I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think we have to be worried about it. Congress is only going to do this if they have to. I mean, this is quite unusual for Congress to require people to do something. So the idea that we are on a slippery slope to Congress forcing you to do all kinds of things you don't want to do just misunderstands political reality.
That's Andrew Koppelman. He teaches law and political science at Northwestern University. Professor Koppelman, thank you.
Very happy to be here.
Now, it turns out that Congress already passed a sort of individual mandate, and it happened in 1798. It was called an Act for the Relief of Sick and Disabled Seamen, and President John Adams signed it into law. Adam Rothman, a history professor at Georgetown, explains.
In the early United States, sailors are an extremely important part of the workforce. Foreign trade and the coastal trade is an enormous part of the national economy. At the same time, it's a dangerous world. Sailors are being impressed into the British Navy. They're also vulnerable to all sorts of diseases. So to maintain the vitality, the health of that workforce and the national economy, Congress feels that it has to step in. So in 1798, Congress passes a law that essentially establishes a national health care system funded by the sailors themselves. The sailors pay a tax to the federal government. The federal government uses that money to set up marine hospitals around the country specifically for sailors.
That's Adam Rothman. He teaches history at Georgetown University. You can read more about the law at our website, npr.org. Long before the Tiger Mom phenomenon, a man named Boris Sidis was touting his child-rearing methods back around 1910. His son was William James Sidis, and to those who knew of him, he was quite possibly the smartest man who ever lived. A few months ago, an inscribed copy of a book Sidis wrote, called The Animate and the Inanimate, was sold in London to an anonymous collector for almost $8,000. The book is about the existence of black holes. It was written more than half a century before Stephen Hawking wrote about the same topic. Now, back in 1937, the New Yorker magazine tracked Sidis down and wrote an account of his life.
One snowy January evening in 1910, about 100 professors and advanced students of mathematics from Harvard University gathered in a lecture hall in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to listen to a speaker by the name of William James Sidis. He had never addressed an audience before, and he was abashed and a little awkward at the start. His listeners had to attend closely, for he spoke in a small voice that did not carry well. The speaker wore black velvet knickers. He was 11 years old.
Probably his voice hadn't changed, and they were agog.
That's Amy Wallace. She wrote a biography about that speaker, William James Sidis. He was presenting a paper called Four-Dimensional Bodies, explaining complex shapes and concepts most of the audience had never even heard of.
He staggered the scientific community of Harvard.
So how did 11-year-old William James Sidis end up lecturing to Harvard's brightest minds? Amy Wallace says it was probably a combination of nature and nurture.
Well, they say he had the highest IQ ever.
It was thought to be 100 points higher than Einstein's. Sidis's parents were pretty smart, too. His dad, Boris Sidis, was a famous psychologist. His mom was a doctor.
They believed that you could make a genius.
His mom put books and maps and even a little globe in his nursery. By the time he was 18 months, he could read the New York Times.
At four, he was speaking Latin. He was writing a novel. He wrote poetry in French. He wrote a constitution for a utopia. He invented his own language. So one thing that was very unusual about William, compared to other child prodigies, very few prodigies have multiple abilities like this.
And by the time he was nine?
By the time he was nine, he was ready for Harvard.
But Harvard wanted Sidis to wait until he was 11, which is when he was first unveiled at that Harvard lecture. 5 years later, he graduated cum laude at the age of 16. But during his time at school, Sidis came to despise the attention he got as one of the youngest students in Harvard's history.
He admitted that he'd never kissed a girl, and he was teased and chased. All he wanted was to get away from academia, be a regular working man.
So Sidis went into hiding. He moved from city to city, job to job, often using an alias, but all the while, he wrote. He wrote a 1,200-page book on the history of the United States. He wrote a book on streetcar transfer tickets, which he loved to collect. And he published his books under at least 8 pseudonyms.
We probably will never know how many books he published under false names.
Sidis lived pretty successfully out of the limelight until that article in 1937.
Finally, when he was 44 years old,
he was befriended by a woman in Boston.
He invited her for a cup of coffee in his apartment, and she queried him about his life.
But the woman was sent there by The New Yorker for a profile. It was the same article that described Sidis's Harvard lecture.
William James Sidis lives today in a hall bedroom of Boston's shabby South End.
And it was humiliating. They made fun of him. They made him sound crazy. They accused him of having a nervous breakdown, which he never had. And Sidis decided to come out of the woodwork and out of hiding and sued The New Yorker.
He sued The New Yorker for libel, and he won. But after the victory,
almost immediately after, that incredible brain exploded. He had a brain hemorrhage, and he died.
At the age of 46, William James Sidis died. His many books were never widely published, at least not under his real name. It's the reason many people today have never even heard of him. Do you think that were he alive today, he would be diagnosed with a social disorder?
Well, Sidis would have probably been referred to as having what's known as Asperger's syndrome. Very bright about your field, but kind of rigid socially. And people who knew him adored him. He was a fantastic friend, a mensch, and a wonderful guy. So, you know, I think he really went from being completely traumatized as a young boy to becoming a happy man.
That's Amy Wallace. She's a biographer of child prodigy William James Sidis. She spoke to us from her home in Los Angeles. This is a new piece of music. Some people call it ethereal, multi-layered, a soundscape that reminds them of Philip Glass or Stephen Reich. And if you like them, this should appeal to you as well. The thing about this piece is that it's the work of an artist somewhat less obscure than the ones I just mentioned. The song is actually called You Smile, and the artist, it's tween heartthrob Justin Bieber. I wait on you forever. Justin Bieber is not responsible for that earlier piece, but they are the same exact song. This song is this song. This version is the song slowed down 800 times. And last summer, a producer posted it online, and it became an internet phenomenon. Thousands and actually millions of people went to hear it. And it turns out that a lot of producers are starting to do the same thing with other music, including one of our own producers, Brent Bachman, who is in the studio with me to explain why. Why are they doing this?
They're doing it because there's this really simple software. It's free. It's easy to use. It's called Paul's Extreme Sound Stretch, and it allows anyone to plug in a song and slow it down hundreds, even thousands of times. And online, people go crazy
for
this stuff.
In discussions.
Yeah, they go crazy for it, and they call it cosmic and ethereal, and they compare it to Brian Eno's early work.
His early work, not his later work.
His early work, right. And the most recent example of this was this past week, someone took the music from the film Jurassic Park.
Ah, yes.
This music right here. And then they took it and they slowed it down 1,000 times. Listen to this.
That's amazing. Aaron Copland, right? I'm thinking like majestic.
Early Aaron Copland.
Early, of course,
right.
Early Aaron. So amazing stuff.
Yeah, and that's what most people online say too.
But does this work with any song? Can you plug any song into this program?
That's the thing. Yeah, I think it might. Let me give you a few examples. Take a listen to this first one.
Okay. Oh, that's gorgeous. Shimmering, yeah. That kind of build up. That,
Any guesses?
No idea. Beautiful. Wow. I did not know Lady Gaga had this in her.
She's a talented lady.
She is indeed.
People go Gaga. Okay, let's hear another one. This is my favorite stretched song.
Wow. I believe that this is the King's College Cambridge men's choir.
You're hearing some church acoustics there?
Yeah. Am I right?
No.
Wow.
You're hearing a ukulele is actually what you're
that
hearing.
That is the same song.
Yeah, Train's Hey Soul Sister.
Train's Hey Soul Sister.
Maybe the worst song of the year.
In your opinion.
Yeah. Okay, let me play you one more that I've stretched out. Kind of sinister.
Yeah. You could imagine this being used in a movie.
Just before the killer strikes.
Just before.
And this song was one of the biggest hits in the year 2000.
I'm blue. I'm blue. This song is an awesome song.
It's a really awful song.
We'll disagree on that one. But that's the same song.
That's the same song. Bad song.
Okay.
I'm going to emphasize again. But if you start with a really complex song, you hear that there are even more possibilities for this kind of technology. Let's take Beethoven's Ninth.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Originally, it's a little more than an hour.
Right.
But back in 2002, a Norwegian producer created a version of the Ninth Symphony slowed down to last 24 hours.
24 hours.
It's called Nine Beat Stretch. So this is Nine Beat Stretch. There's an artist in San Francisco named Aaron Zim.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, he hosted a listening event at a warehouse there, and he invited people to come and spend 24 hours listening to this music.
It's that quality of suspension and the pace of our lives and the rapidity with which we shift from one multitask task to another to actually stay with something for as long as this technique allows you to do. It's kind of a novel experience.
24 hours. I hope he served food there.
I didn't ask him that. They did have beanbags, though.
Hmm.
Hearing sound like this gives your brain the opportunity to move into synchrony with it and itself slow down. You realize that you don't have to be in a hurry. You can sort of stay here for a while and take a look around with your ears.
I don't know if I'd want to hear it for 24 hours, but it is, I mean, it really is amazing.
What if you had a beanbag?
Maybe.
Okay. Let me play you one more. This is from an artist you had on the show last week,
right?
One of my favorites. A track from the new Decemberists album.
Yes.
Yeah, that I think sounds great at any speed.
Right.
But listen to it slowed down about 50 times. This is their new track, Don't Carry It All, and if you stick around to the end of the podcast, we'll play a few more slowed down songs.
All right, Brent, thanks so much.
Sure.
February 6th will mark 100 years since the birth of one of the most popular presidents in American history, Ronald Reagan. His story's been told by several biographers, but none quite in the way that his son, Ron, tells it. Ron Reagan's written a new memoir about his dad and their relationship. It's called My Father at 100.
It wasn't that I had in mind some particular thing that I wanted to say about him that I felt other people hadn't said. What I was really looking for was keys to his character and personality, particularly the inner character, the metaphorical 10% that I talk about in the book that he rarely let anybody see, even his own family, even his own wife, that the keys to that character would be found in his early life. And so I went hunting around in those early days.
What was your dad's relationship like with his past? I mean, you went back to Tampico, you went back to Dixon, Illinois, you drove through that part of the country where he grew up and then left, of course, to Hollywood in his youth. Did he kind of want to put that behind him or recreate it, or did he embrace it?
Well, all of those things, in a way. He certainly embraced it. He did like to, as I point out in the book, in some instances, he does a little script editing. You know, he will relate stories from his past, but he will eliminate uncomfortable aspects. The story of him when he was on his college football team, pulled into a hotel, there are two black players on the team, and they learn that the black players won't be welcome to stay in the hotel. Coach says, you know, fine, we'll sleep on the bus. And my father intervenes and convinces him to send his two black friends home with him. And that way the team can sleep in a hotel and be comfortable, and the black players won't feel like they're the cause of, you know, us all shivering on a bus all night. He would not, when he would relate the story to me in later, much later years, admit that it was Dixon that was the town where this hotel wouldn't take black people.
Wow.
And that no other hotel in the town would accept black people. Now, he refers to racism in his autobiography as these tumors of racism within the country. Well, that poses a problem for him. Is Dixon a tumor? Is Dixon an ugly aberration in the country? Or On the other hand, is the country, even North, even in the land of Lincoln, systemically racist, which makes it a little tough to see it as a kind of amber-tinged, shining city on a hill. So he was kind of stuck in a catch-22 there and, made some editing cuts there to try and paper that over, I think.
Ron Reagan, I'm sure you've had a variation of this question over the course of your life, but mm-hmm. given that you're so publicly associated with, let's say, progressive politics today,
mm-hmm.
how do you sort of deal or respond to questions about the fact that you are the son of this conservative icon? I mean, the most important, arguably, conservative icon.
Well, you see him as a conservative icon, of course. I see him as my father. Most people see him as the former president of the United States, which, of course, I grant you, I recognize also. But to me, he's my father. And fathers and sons, parents and children have been arguing over politics and disagreeing over politics for as long as there have been parents, children, and politics.
Did you ever upset him with sort of being frank about your views on an issue?
He was difficult to upset, and he certainly wasn't – he didn't get upset just because you happened to disagree with him. Now, he did think that if he could get you alone for 5 or 10 minutes, that he could convince you of his point of view. I imagine he found it a bit frustrating that over the years that didn't seem to work with me all the time. But that wasn't something that I was going to particularly bother about in the book. I did not want this book to be a political book. I wasn't out to settle scores with him in any way. I argued with him plenty when he was alive and we could do it face to face. I had no intention of picking a fight with him he wouldn't be able to defend himself.
You intersperse bits of your dad's biography with recollections of your relationship with him. And at one point he said to you, and I love this quote, he said, "You're my son, so I have to love you, but sometimes you make it very hard to like you."
yes.
do you remember what he was responding to?
I don't remember exactly what it was, no. I mean, we would get, of course, we'd have difficulties. I was a teenager at that time. I was probably 16, 17
years
old.
You grew your hair long, and you were the son of Ronald Reagan.
Oh, sure. I wore thrift store clothes and military surplus, was against the Vietnam War, and I was an atheist, and, all sorts of – listened to music that he couldn't understand, and, strange smells would emerge from my bedroom occasionally, and all of that sort of thing. So, he wasn't happy about that. But again, that's, I think, a sentiment that a lot of parents may feel about their teenage children. It can, the teenage years can be a bit rocky.
I'm curious to know what you make of the sort of veneration of Ronald Reagan. You call it a fetish in the book. And I want to play a clip of some of what that might sound like.
Okay. All right.
Who is your favorite Republican president?
Ronald Reagan.
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 Reagan. He brought me into the Republican Party.
I'm proud to have been a member of the Reagan Revolution
and the Reagan Principles.
Aside from President Reagan, who is your political hero?
This is a trick question. Yeah. Hang on.
Everybody loves Ronald Reagan.
Loves Ronald Reagan.
Does it make you uncomfortable, or do you sort of distance yourself from that?
It does make me uncomfortable. I understand it. I mean, if you're a Republican candidate for president or any other office for that matter, who are you going to venerate in the Republican Party? George W. Bush? No, I don't think so. H.W. Bush? Not so inspiring. Nixon? No, that's not going to work for you. Ronald Reagan's pretty much it.
But nonetheless, you call it a fetish.
Well, I think, as you just demonstrated, it becomes so reflexive and so almost fetishistic that really he's like the rubber bustier of the Republican Party. They're so all over him.
Ron Reagan, in many ways, this book that you've written seems to be about a son getting to know a part of his father that he really didn't know. The Ronald Reagan behind the Edmund Morris book. Biography Dutch.
By the way, it's much easier to write a history of your father if Pulitzer Prize-winning biographers paved the way for you and left just reams of footnotes for you to go through.
At the end of your journey, what did you discover about your dad that maybe changed the way you think about him or surprised you?
I don't think there were any huge surprises or things that fundamentally changed the way I thought about him. But it is true that I have a new and I hope deeper appreciation for the solitary, undersized little boy that he was, who spent a lot of time by himself, you know, poring over books and strange artifacts, some of them from the West, which, you know, filled his head with visions of this wide open frontier and this broad landscape in which he could be a hero, the guy who saves the day. I think I have a better appreciation of that.
That's Ron Reagan. He's the son of the late President Ronald Reagan. His new book is called My Father at 100. It's in bookstores now. Ron Reagan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Guy, thanks for having me.
Tell me, baby, tell me. Are you still on the stoop, watching the windows close?
This is the music that made legions of fans fall in love with the band Iron and Wine back in 2002. But actually, at that point, it wasn't much of a band at all. Iron and Wine was one man named Sam Beam, alone with his guitar. The songs were barely whispers, delicate, tender home recordings. Now, a decade into his recording career, Sam Beam has gone through a series of transformations. His latest album is called Kiss Each Other Clean, and it's a whole new Iron and Wine. That is the same artist, and Sam Beam is here with me in NPR's performance studio. Sam Beam, welcome to NPR.
Hey, Guy, how's it going?
What a contrast in sounds. I mean, obviously, a major change.
That's funny. I hadn't listened to him back, you know, side by side like that. That was interesting. As someone who's working and recording music and writing songs and stuff, you know, you just keep moving forward.
Yeah.
You know, you don't think about, really.
I mean, there was a saxophone in that.
There was a saxophone.
And amazing. I mean, it had this kind of J.J. Cale Southern Shuffle sound to it.
Yeah.
And but you, for such a long time, you were a man with a guitar.
I remember, you know, in the early days, trying to find the right setting for a group of lyrics or something, you know, the perfect stage for a set of lyrics, whereas now, you know, as you get into it, you keep trying to surprise yourself and push yourself into new areas because putting out the same record is boring.
I want to take a listen to another song off the new Iron and Wine album. This one's called Walking Far From Home.
I was walking far from home, where the names were not burned along the wall. So a wet road formed a circle, and it came like a call, came like a call from the Lord. Oh.
That song ends with a line, it came like a call from the Lord. And there a lot of religious themes scattered throughout your work. Why do you keep going back to...
Well, I mean, I grew up in South Carolina. You know, it's kind of a big deal there.
Is it a big deal to you?
Well, you know, it's part of my upbringing. We went to church, and, you know, that's the characters that we were taught to learn about morality. And then, you know, it's, at the same time, it's an easy way to say... for instance, there's a song that includes Cain and Abel.
Yeah.
And I could say, you know, Joe and Bob, who represent one is jealous and cruel, one is innocent and, you know, everything we want to be. But at the same time, they represent the duality that lives in each of us. You know, you could get into all that, or I could just say Cain and Abel went to McDonald's and smoked a bag of weed and, you know, and it means something else. You know, you could create an economy of language.
Sam, since I have you here in the studio, I wonder if I could get you, and you have a guitar with you, not your saxophone this time, but I was wondering
if... wouldn't be fun, trust me.
I'm sure it'd be fun. I'm hoping that you could play us a song.
Sure, this song's called Tree by the River. The dark canyon wall, the call and the answer, and the mare in the pasture, pitch black and baring its teeth. I recall the sun in our faces, stuck and leaning on graces, and being strangers to change. The radio and the bones we found frozen, and all the thorns and the roses beneath your window. Now I'm asleep in a car, I mean the world, to a party mouth girl and a pretty pair of blue-eyed birds. Time isn't kind or unkind, you like to say, but I wonder to who and what it is you're saying today.
Beautiful song.
Thanks.
That was Sam Beam. He is Iron and Wine, and that song's called Tree by the River. It's on his new record, Kiss Each Other Clean. Again, what a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song.
And appreciate that.
That song, like a lot of your songs, is so visual. It's almost like you're describing scenes from a silent film. The tree by the river, the dark canyon road, the half moon. Do you try to make it visual?
I guess, you know, I went to an art school. I got into cinema.
You even taught filmmaking at the time.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm drawn to this sort of visual communication style. I find it it leaves room for the viewer or the listener or whatever to participate with you. The song doesn't succeed on whether I explain my point sufficiently. You set up a few different images and make connections between the two, and the listener can make their own assumptions of what things mean. You know, a tree by the river, you know, a tree means something, a river means something, and then what you describe after that paints those images, you know.
You are, you have a film background. You kind of fell into the music business. I mean, this was your hobby, you said.
Right. Yeah, I got a phone call from Sub Pop, this record label from Seattle, you know, Sub Pop, like Nirvana Sub Pop.
Yeah,
and so I was like, are you sure you have the right number? You know, but at the same time, I had children, so it wasn't like I could just drop everything and go do music. I had to really consider, but at the end of the day, it seemed a lot more fun than class, to be honest.
Yeah. That's Sam Beam. He's better known as Iron and Wine. His new album is called Kiss Each Other Clean. Sam Beam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
And would you mind leaving us with one more song before you take off?
Sure, sure. This song is called Half Moon.
And if you'd like to hear both of the songs Sam Beam performed in our studio and his Tiny Desk concert, they're at our website, nprmusic.org.
Halfway home in the hilltop.
rooftop trees and all our footprints in the snow and the evening glow leaving. Low night noise in the winter time, I wake beside you on the floor, counting your breathing. 'Cause I can't see nothing in this half moon.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program is directed by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, and Hansi Wong, with help this week from Liz Baker. Our intern is Megan Keane. Michael Kennedy is filling in for Rick Holter as our editor. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz. And finally, as promised, a few more super stretched songs. You have 10 seconds to guess the original. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays.
Macarena, que tu cuerpo para dar la alegría y cosa buena. Hala tu cuerpo, alegría, Macarena.